Enjoy.
This is Tony White, publisher of Listen and Learn Cassettes. Neil Rackham is chairman of his own international research and consulting organization operating in over 20 countries. He's also author of several books on management. Neil has done intensive psychological studies of the negotiating weapons of over 200 multinational corporate executives, and as a result, has developed a series of new tools and techniques covering the psychology of negotiating. These are techniques you can use immediately to become a better negotiator yourself. Listen and learn how as we join Neil live at a recent seminar.
Negotiation is defined by some people as that face-to-face formal bargaining process that takes place across a table. If you just think of negotiation that way, you're thinking of it in too limited a context. I think negotiation is something much wider than that. On the other hand, I've heard people say negotiation is almost any conversation where you've got an axe to grind. And clearly, that's too wide a view. Somewhere in between comes this thing that we shall call negotiation. If I had to define negotiation, I'd say a negotiation is something where three things are happening. The first aspect of negotiation is you're not negotiating unless you have the authority, the ability to vary the terms in some way. Negotiation never is, never will be, never has been a substitute for selling. Almost every great negotiator I've had the opportunity to study put a tremendous amount of effort into how they pre-sold their position in the months that led up to the negotiation. Second thing that makes negotiation what it is we usually negotiate when a resource is scarce. So far, there's enough chairs for everyone to sit on. So, chairs aren't a negotiable issue. They would be if there weren't enough chairs. We often think of negotiation with a box around it, as though we only negotiate in that formal way across the table. But most of us are negotiating dozens of times a day. And most of our negotiations are around scarce resources. We negotiate about priorities. We negotiate about budgets. We all build up a lot of negotiating experience and skill that we may not even recognize that we've built up. A third point about negotiation, any negotiation, whatever it is, could always be represented by two circles that have a degree of overlap but not total overlap. In one circle are the things that I want, in the other circle, the things that you want. We have in the same discussion some areas of agreement or common ground, some areas of conflict or frustration. In any negotiation, there must be something in it for you to keep you there. On the other hand, it's equally true in any negotiation, if it's going all your way, it isn't a negotiation. Nearly everything I was reading on negotiation a few years ago was how to come to a deal with a person you've never met before and hopefully you're never going to meet again. Something like 95% of the negotiations I had were with my employees, my customers, my suppliers, my bankers, people where it was important that I maintained a position where I'd be able to go back and do better in the future. And this is a major problem in negotiation. Most of our emphasis on how to negotiate has been about how to gain a short-term advantage from one negotiation. But of course, there's a simple rule here which you don't have to be a psychologist to work out, and that's this: you can con anybody once. Is coming back the second time where the difficulties start. When I was picking up the sort of book you see on airport bookstands by the world's greatest negotiator and looking in there, I'd see whole lists of dirty tricks about how to pull a fast one on some poor unsuspecting person or how to make the kind of fuss where no one would ever want you back again. I asked myself, is there a place for that in my business? And my general conclusion was, no, I don't think there is. So we started looking at negotiators who were good at keeping a long-term negotiation climate, not the ones who necessarily got some very quick short-term gain. And if you find differences between the things that I'll be talking about and some of the things that you'll read in the 27 quick ways to gain a fast advantage in a negotiation, the difference basically comes back to this. I'm not interested too much in the one-off negotiation because, frankly, I don't have many of those negotiations, and I guess neither do you. The thing that really interests me is the kind of negotiation where I am going to have to do future business with those people. Now, that, of course, doesn't mean that a long-term negotiation is a soft negotiation. Far from it. How aggressive should you be in a negotiation? If there's one area that has been argued for years by the specialists who study negotiation, it's the area of what's the role of being aggressive. You'll get a lot of winning negotiations through intimidation people who say negotiation is about being tough. You role play quite extraordinary fireworks inside the negotiation. You're very aggressive. You play it very hard line. You work by confrontation and conflict. Because negotiation, by definition, has conflict in it. And you capitalize on it. Now, there's another school of thought that says, no, a negotiation is about a relationship, and you don't build relationships through aggression. This school of thought says, perhaps it's better in a negotiation to always try to play it cool, low-key, soft, tactfully, and that way you build an effective climate. Now, I know which of those two I would like to believe was true. I'd like to believe that the world's a nice place, and if you negotiate decently, gently, patiently, in the end you'll be rewarded. But I don't see a lot of statistical evidence of the meek inheriting the earth right now. Who's right? One way of answering that is to look at expert negotiators and see if they're more aggressive in their negotiation than average negotiators. That's a pretty simple way to collect some evidence. The expert negotiators were less aggressive than the average negotiators. It was the average guys who thumped the table, who flexed their muscles, who played it tough, who threatened, who used aggression, who attacked the other side. The experts did much less of that. But that disguises the second conclusion, which is even more important. Sometimes the experts would be aggressive in negotiation. Sometimes they would attack the other side. But the way they attacked was different. Do you know how most of us attack others in a negotiation? What we do is we sit there in a negotiation and we're getting more and more frustrated because we're not getting what we want and the other side is behaving, in our perception, unreasonably. So we mount a little needling attack to see what will happen. And the other side, feeling themselves attacked, says, hey, and they respond with a counterattack on us. We then, of course, escalate the attack a bit, and so they throw a stone at us, and we throw a rock at them, and before you know what's happened, we're in a thing called a defend-attack spiral. You know, this is how quarrels start. They work up from small beginnings, each side escalating it a little bit. The skilled negotiator avoids these defend-attack spirals. But let's just leave the aggressive area in terms of saying don't do it often, and if you must do it hard. I'd like to move to a small but interesting mistake that most people make when they negotiate. Most of us, if we've been around in negotiation for an awful long time, we get used to keeping our cool. But because negotiation is a frustrating business, because you're never getting quite what you want out of it, we let that frustration out in ways we don't intend. One of the things we do is we use a little thing called an irritator. We use words or phrases which don't add anything, but they certainly irritate the other side. The most common irritator in the English language is all one word, the generous offer. Suppose I say to you, I'm making you a very generous offer. What impact does that word generous have on you? Does it make you think, wow, I'm impressed? No, of course it doesn't. If you're on the receiving end of a generous offer, you would find the communication much more effective if that wretched word generous weren't in there. We say, we're being fair, we're being reasonable. These words, fair, reasonable, generous, are just a backdoor way of saying to the other side, we see you as being unfair, unreasonable, mean. And that's how they communicate. I'd like to discuss a couple of points with you now that I think are much more important to negotiation and where most of you may find yourself damaging your negotiations if you don't take these points into account. I was always taught to negotiate like this. I was taught that a negotiation starts off with one side putting a proposal. The other side replies with their counterproposal. The two are relatively far apart, so we discuss and bargain and talk in an attempt to bring the two close enough together to have an agreement. That's how I was taught to negotiate, and I guess that's how most of you have been taught to negotiate. As a result, if I was in a negotiation and the other side put forward a proposal, I'd immediately reply with my counterproposal. I'd say, thank you for your position, here's ours. And then hope we could start the bargaining process. When we did our research, one of the curious things we discovered that we didn't understand at the time was that the skilled negotiator tended to avoid these counterproposals, tended not to respond to a proposal from the other side with one of their own. So we were a little surprised by this information. Why is it the average negotiator is almost twice as likely to respond to a proposal with a proposal of their own? What is it the skilled negotiator is avoiding here and why? At first, we didn't have any real understanding of this. We had to stop and think about it. And then something struck us. If you look at a skilled negotiator, they understand something fundamental about the psychology of persuasion that perhaps the average negotiator doesn't. And that's this. There's a simple law of psychology which tells you that a person will be least responsive to the idea of someone else when they have just put forward an idea of their own. And that doesn't just apply in negotiation. You sit in a meeting. What happens when one person puts forward an idea and someone else immediately comes up with a better idea? Who's the last person in the room to accept the better idea? It's always going to be the person who put up the first one. You see, if I put something to you, if I put a proposal to you now, what am I listening for in your reply? I'm listening for whether you accept our proposal. I'm listening for whether you like it, whether you don't like it. So if you say to me, our counterproposal is this, what do I hear? Do I hear from you an honest problem-solving idea? Not on your life. You are disagreeing with my position. You watch a good negotiator at work, and the way they handle it is that if the other side has got their proposal in, they put their attention around that proposal, which does help that proposal appear to be listened to. But they do more than listen. They usually ask a lot of questions about it. They say, how would that work over here? Wouldn't that run into problems there? Isn't that going to be impractical because of this and this and this reason? Because you can't wait. And many of us put our best ideas at the worst possible moment in terms of their receptivity by others. Remember that simple psychological principle that a person will have least receptivity to your ideas when they've just put forward their own. And therefore, if the other side has put their proposal in first, back off. Don't think of putting yours. Allow it to wind down. Acknowledge it, question it, examine it, and then and only then start introducing your own proposal. I've seen some very fine and otherwise acceptable ideas get lost in negotiation because they're put at that psychologically wrong moment. If there is just one thing I could tell you about negotiation, if I was only allowed to give you one piece of advice, it would be the piece of advice I'm going to give you right now. Most of us in negotiation make a terrible mistake. And it's one that I'm particularly susceptible to making, and I therefore have empathy with anyone who has problems with this. Most of us have a grave disadvantage called higher education. Back in the 1950s, people began to notice something which no one took any great degree of interest in at the time, but perhaps they should have done. And that was this. It appears that some of the world's greatest negotiators are very smart people, but very uneducated people. All things being equal, it appears that education not only doesn't help you become a better negotiator, it may actually stand in your way. And that seems very strange, because one would think that education would be a great asset in terms of negotiation. Fewer arguments I use, the stronger the case is likely to be. So here we have two different ways of thinking about arguing. One is what we might call additive and the other subtractive. The additive way is to say, it's like a pair of scales, so if you can add a few more arguments, you make your overall case more persuasive. The other is the subtractive model, the dilution model, which says every argument you add, the weakest part of it subtracts from the total. Now, which is true in real life? Well, the test of that will be watching skilled negotiators at work. If the balance model is true, what you would expect is that the skilled negotiator would be using more arguments. If it's true that it's like a pair of scales, then skilled negotiators will be people who will probably put a lot on their scale pan. The weight of the argument will be in their favor. They'll probably use more. On the other hand, if the dilution model is true, if a weak argument dilutes a strong one, the skilled negotiator will probably be using fewer arguments to back up their case, because every argument they use is another piece of ammunition for the other side to get back at. Well, which is true? It turns out that the dilution model is true. It appears that a weak argument dilutes a strong one, and the skilled negotiator avoids diluting arguments. Now, I'd like you to look at this from a slightly different angle. What I'm saying there might strike you as, yeah, maybe that's logical, but it might not prevent you from falling into an awful trap. I don't often give people dirty tricks, but I would like to give you one little dirty trick that you'll find very useful with some of those parasitic adjuncts to negotiations, lawyers, MBAs, you know, people of this kind, who I find so often get in the way between me and making progress. If you're negotiating with a highly educated person, I found that I can very often gain tremendous advantage by one simple technique. They'll put forward a case, and because they're smart and they've done their homework, they put forward a very strong position. And they say, here's the reason why we put this position forward. And I say to them, is that your only reason? And of course, as it's a matter of virility in the balance model not to only have one argument, they immediately respond to this by saying, oh no, no, here's another reason. And if I can't crack that one, I say, is that all? And usually they'll say obligingly, no, 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 I've got a really feeble one here somewhere. Wait a minute. And then they give me something that I can get back at. So I go in and I destroy their weak point And I say, on the basis of that, I can't accept your case. And yet, that's exactly what most of us do. Be honest with yourself. Ask yourself what you would have done if you'd been negotiating with me just now. And I'd said, is that your only reason? I wonder honestly how many of you would have said, no, no, here's another one. No? And fallen into an appalling trap of doubling my ammunition. Don't think of a negotiation as a pair of scales. Don't think of arguing as adding reasons. Think of it as providing ammunition to the other side to come back at you. And because of that, always, always try to win your case on one key reason. Once somebody has said yes, they're usually quite favorably disposed to hearing reasons why it was a good thing to have said yes. It's just those reasons won't cause them to say yes. So sometimes you see a good negotiator after the negotiation, after the agreement has been reached, revealing those additional reasons in a way that reinforces the other side and makes them think, yeah, we were probably smart to agree to that. So far, everything I've said to you has been about don'ts. I've said, don't use these irritators. Don't be aggressive and attack. Don't use counterproposals. Don't dilute your argument. I mean, this list of don'ts could go on forever. But that's half the story. Those are the things the skilled negotiator doesn't do. I want to turn to the things that the skilled negotiator does do and look at those things which make the skilled negotiator different because instead of avoiding them, they use these techniques to give them progress and to help them in negotiations. One of the things which we find about the very skilled negotiator is that top negotiators come over with a great deal of clarity. They seem very easy to read, not difficult to read. What is it the skilled negotiator is doing to enable them to communicate more clearly than the average negotiator? Well, we can isolate at least one of the things that the skilled negotiator is doing. In a negotiation, if I'm an average negotiator, I might be asking you some questions. How many of these are there? How would that work? What would be your interpretation of this clause? Those are questions. And I might just ask them, as I've asked them now. If you watch a top negotiator in action, a top negotiator is much more likely to let you know when a question is coming, rather than just ask the question. Instead of saying, how many are there, they'll say, excuse me, could I ask you a question? How many are there? Instead of just making a proposal, they'd say, at this point, I would like to make a proposal. And then they'll make their proposal. So there are various reasons why labeling your behavior, why letting people know what's coming, can help in a negotiation. One of those reasons is that if you're in a group negotiation, labeling can put attention of the whole group on the person who you want to reply from. And one of the things we all know is how easy it is not to answer questions unless everyone's expecting an answer. If I say, can I ask you a question? What I'm saying to everyone in the room is the next thing I say demands an answer from you. And it's harder for you to get off the hook. If you look at skilled negotiators, they let people know in advance what's coming, with the exception of anything which involves a disagreement, of which an attack would be the most extreme form. The skilled negotiator is much less likely to let someone know when a disagreement is coming. Most negotiators, and not only negotiators, most people, will disagree by saying, I don't agree because. In other words, you say the disagreement first, and you come on to give the reason for that disagreement afterwards. A skilled negotiator is much more likely to say, here is a point that I'd like us to consider and discuss. And they put the reason first, and then if necessary, they may lead up to a disagreement. On the other hand, the average negotiator is much more likely to begin with a disagreement, I don't agree with that, and then go on to give the reason. What I'd like to talk about now is something which does kill negotiations. Most of us in negotiations are very concerned with how we get our points across to the other side, as though somehow the points we make are going to have impact and are going to persuade. Now, if there's one fundamental law of psychology which has been known for almost 2,500 years, in fact, my co-discoverer was the Greek writer Herodotus in about 400 BC. He said the Thracians are very, very skilled negotiators. They ask a lot of questions. Any good negotiator asks an awful lot of questions. They don't tell, they ask, and that's their way of persuading. The average negotiator is mostly concerned with how they get their points across. They try to persuade by telling. But you can tell people till you're blue in the face. That doesn't persuade. People discover in themselves. You don't discover it for them. The questions you ask reveal the legitimacy of your point. It's much better that I can ask you two or three questions that make you think about an area and say yes, then I try and ram that down your throat by telling you, here is why, a negotiation. But clearly, questions get you information. But they do a lot of other things as well. The person who's asking the questions has control over the discussion because they're getting the other side to put cards on the table. They're not putting their own. When you watch very skilled negotiators negotiating with each other, the number of questions is a major negotiable issue. A skilled negotiator negotiating with an amateur asks all the questions. Two skilled negotiators together, and they tend to alternate questions. Wait a minute, I've answered a couple of yours, and I think you should now answer a question of mine before we go on with this. Because questions give a great deal of control over the discussion. One of the things we sometimes do is we get people to negotiate, and we don't allow them to ask questions. We press a little buzzer every time they try and ask a question, and we see what happens. It's very frustrating if you can't ask questions, because questions are what give you control over the discussion, because they tell you what areas are important to get into. We've talked about how ill-advised it is to just disagree, saying, I disagree with that because the skilled negotiator often uses questions as an alternative way of disagreeing. So instead of me saying, that won't work in this area, it's far smarter for me to say, tell me, please, how would that work in this area? Because if it genuinely won't work in that area, the other side hasn't got a comeback. It's much better that they are then in the position of saying, well, there may be some difficulties. Or on the other hand, if they have a perfect answer, clearly it wouldn't have been any good me saying, here's why it wouldn't work, because they could have answered that and put my case down anyway. Questions are a powerful alternative to disagreeing in a negotiation. They also have dirty tricks functions. By asking questions, you can get some thinking time. Because while the other party is answering a question, they can't also think. I'm a little sensitive to this one. I recall the first major negotiation I ever carried out on behalf of my company in New York. Here's me, a little country boy, coming up to New York City and having a negotiation with a New York lawyer. And this New York lawyer was the kind of guy with six rows of teeth and a really fearsome character. And we were going through a contract, and he kept saying, Neil, clause 8 here, I don't understand, let me ask you questions about it. And I was answering forever these rigid questions about a very unimportant clause. At the end of the negotiation, when I'd signed away 42.1% of my soul, he said, Well, I'm glad we've settled that, Neil. How do you feel? And I said, well, I just have one question, and that is, what was the problem around Clause 8? He said, there was no problem, but while you were answering my questions there, you'll see I've figured out a way to screw you on Clause 5. His mistake was saying that in front of witnesses, as subsequent litigation showed, but once bitten, twice shy. And one of the pieces of advice is, if anyone starts asking you a lot of questions around an area that doesn't seem relevant, don't think, wow, I'm off the hook, this is an irrelevant area. Think, why? Because if you're up against a good negotiator, they're usually doing that to keep your mind occupied while they figure something out. One of the most valuable things you can do to help your negotiation is to plan a list of questions. That gives you a lot of flexibility in the negotiation. If ever you get into difficulty in one area, you can turn to any one of the questions on your list and say, well, just a moment, could I ask you about this? Gets you off the hook, gets some information, can help you. But most of us don't plan that. We think that the questions will just arise spontaneously during the negotiation. We spend a lot of thought about what we're going to tell, but not enough thought about what we're going to ask. But the fundamental psychological rule is this: telling is non-persuasive. Anyone who has worked on that miracle of persuasion resistance, the adolescent kid, knows that you can tell and you can tell and you can tell and you do not make a scrap of difference. If you are going to communicate, if you are going to change a view, it has to be very much through asking the right questions. Questions persuade when telling doesn't. So preparing a list of questions is one of the smartest things you can do, and very few people do that. The important thing is never allow anyone to get you on a roll, asking you question after question after question after question. That's when you begin to lose out there. There are several other things that you can do. One of the things which most of us are not skilled at doing, but it's very important, is to learn to answer questions with questions. No? We're taught from being very young that questions are things that demand answers. And we will often just almost automatically feel we should answer. Never be afraid to answer a question with a question. You know, one of the remarkable things about the psychology of how people behave in negotiation is how much of it is conditioned by your very earlier experience. One of the reasons why questions are so powerful is that we learn in school that when the teacher is telling, you can read a comic book under the desk and that's fine, because telling behavior doesn't require a response, so you're safe. You don't even have to listen. But the moment the teacher starts asking questions, you better pay attention, because questions are a high-risk behavior. One of the things that you have to be very careful about is, as soon as anyone sees your questioning as a trap, they'll obviously do their best to avoid it. And the worst trap is the sort of person who asks you a whole series of questions and then smiles smugly and says, gotcha. And if ever you've been at the receiving end of that, you become very suspicious. The questions should lead towards a conclusion, and ideally that conclusion should be acceptable to both the parties. Suppose I'm trying to get you to say, this is going to be very difficult in terms of application. You're proposing something and I'm saying it's unworkable. So instead of me saying, I disagree with you, it's unworkable, I say, how would it work? And I ask you lots of questions about how would it work, and your answers pretty well reveal it's unworkable. The important thing is that we draw that conclusion between us, and that I don't say, see, it's unworkable. That I'm really saying, so you're saying that this, and you're agreeing that there would be some ambiguities. An average negotiator, above everything, wants to get an agreement. So in the negotiation, as long as they can get a signature on a piece of paper, they think they've done fine. Therefore, if there's a misunderstanding or a misperception, they'll often leave it alone, gloss over it, in the hope that they can just get the signature. A skilled negotiator wants an agreement which will work. If something isn't tough enough and strong enough to be prodded and tested while it's being agreed, it isn't strong enough to stand up to real life afterwards. And if you have to reopen a negotiation with a lot of misperceptions and recriminations, and you promised us this, no, we didn't, well, it says this here, but we didn't mean that, what we meant was, that's the kind of atmosphere where you've done yourself infinitely more damage than good out of that whole process. It may take you a little longer to arrive at the agreement, but you arrive at a much more substantial agreement as a result of that. Anyone can get a signature. But getting a signature which works takes longer and is harder and involves much more patience and difficulty. Let me turn to one final area of face-to-face negotiation. I could give you another very unhelpful piece of advice, something which would do absolutely nothing for you, and something which most books on negotiation agree about, and that is, negotiation is all about trust. You try to create trust as a negotiator. So create trust, okay? Got it? I'd like you in all your negotiations to create trust on the other side. And again, that's like saying be successful. The issue is how. And that's a difficult issue. Trusting someone is very different from liking someone. There are some people I like very well, but I wouldn't trust them to help me cross the street. On the other hand, I trust some of my sworn enemies. Trust is something quite independent of whether you feel good about a person. Therefore, trying to create trust solely by being a nice person and trying to be liked is an unsuccessful strategy. Now, one of the things which we find interesting is that the skilled negotiator actually comes over much more as a normal person during negotiation than the average negotiator. The average negotiator cuts off all the inner parts of themselves and comes over very objectively, because we've been taught to do that in negotiation, because negotiation is a very sort of formal process. The really good negotiators, particularly those who make a breakthrough in difficult situations, come over as a person first and a negotiator second. Think of people you've seen who've been able to come into a difficult situation and turn it round. And how often they just seem sort of people who came in and were very natural and very normal and didn't get uptight and managed to come over as individuals. One of the problems about negotiation is both sides are often under tension. And if you have people under tension talking to each other, they tend to be very closed, and they don't come over as people. Often, by starting the negotiation, you get some of the tensions on the table, and you get initial positions discussed, and then a longish coffee break is a very valuable thing. Now, some of the questions there are how. One technique that I find particularly valuable and useful is something which most of us just don't do in negotiations, and my gosh, we should. I will not trust somebody who I believe isn't even listening to my point of view. If someone puts a point to you, it's often a very smart thing to show that you understand their point. That creates trust. You don't have to agree with it. So if you put a point to me, it's smart for me to say, so what you're saying is that this is very important to you, and the reason why it's important to you is this and this. And because of that, you're putting forward the position the way you're putting it forward right here. Yeah, I understand that. Now, I don't agree with it, and I'm not going to give it to you, but I've heard you, and I've demonstrated I've heard you by showing my understanding of your position. And you feel much more comfortable about me because you're clear that you have got through to me and you're a little more receptive about me getting through to you. If you can be very clear about that difference, it really helps you in negotiation. Always show that you understand. That doesn't mean that you show that you accept. I show I understand by saying, your position, as I understand it, is this. The difficulty you're in right now is that you can't accept the position that I put forward for this and this reason. Yeah, I understand that. In order to create trust, you usually have to display a little bit of vulnerability. You don't actually, in reality, make yourself much more vulnerable by doing things that show that you're a person, an individual with feelings, perceptions. I'm not, by this, suggesting that you should lay your negotiating cards on the table. It's actually not a better protection to come across as a cold, impartial, objective negotiator. How do you improve a relationship? Episodes in the family, for example, when people haven't been talking to each other for years, and suddenly that changes. It always changes with one side disclosing a little bit and revealing a little bit about themselves and their positions and their feelings. Whatever kind of personality you've got, the kinds of little techniques and skills we've talked of here can help your negotiation. These points, simple though they are, can make a measurable difference to your negotiation. The skilled negotiator tends to use certain things more than the average negotiator. Remember, we talked about behavior labeling. We said the skilled negotiator lets you know what's coming. Doesn't just ask a question, says, can I ask a question? The exception there is disagreeing. The skilled negotiator does not let you know the disagreement, and in particular, attacking, is coming. We talked about the value of testing and summarizing to clarify key points before you get the agreement. Never let a substantial misunderstanding through. Remember, your objective is not an agreement, it's an agreement that will work. Therefore, always test. Are you sure that you mean this? This is what we mean. How do you interpret that? Get absolute clarity before you get agreement or you're in trouble. We talked about the value of questions, not just to get information. There's an alternative to disagreement, a way of controlling the discussion, as a way of getting thinking time. And we've finally been talking here about this feelings commentary, where we said a feelings commentary, talking about your inner feelings and perceptions, coming over as a person, fundamentally, is a very smart thing to do in negotiation, and many of us cut off that piece of ourselves to our own detriment. We said that there's certain things that you shouldn't do in negotiation, of which a very simple one is don't use these irritators, fair, reasonable, generous. They don't help you to persuade, cut them out. We've said, in general, don't be aggressive in a negotiation. It doesn't help you. But in particular, never get into one of these spirals where you're gently aggressive, just enough to stoke up the other side. The rule is, if you are going to hit, hit hard. Never, never, please never say, excuse me, please can I kick you? It doesn't work. If you're going to kick, no warning and kick hard. We talked about counterproposals and we said a person is least receptive to the idea of somebody else when they've just put forward an idea of their own. And yet that's exactly the point in a negotiation where most of us start slipping in our counterproposals. Don't do it. Back off. Ask questions. Show problems with that proposal. Always try to introduce your counterproposal as a way out of problems, not as a competitive proposal. Finally, we talked about argument dilution. And there's a rule that is the most important single rule in the psychology of negotiation, and it's this: a weak argument dilutes a strong. It doesn't add, it takes away. The more arguments you use, the more ammunition you give. So when in doubt, leave it out. And just ask yourself, how would you have responded if someone said, is that your only reason? So many of us would obligingly have doubled the ammunition. Watch out for that. Never get caught on that. If anyone does ask you that, the obvious comeback is, well, I've given you a reason. Does that mean you accept my point? Learn to do those things. Many of them you may already be doing. Everyone is good at some parts of negotiation and less good at others. If you look at yourself, of the 8 things we discussed there, you're probably good on 2 or 3 of them. Thing to do is to pick out some of the others where you can also become good.
Before we sign off, we want to invite you to send us your comments and suggestions for other programs you'd like to see.